The stories we tell about ourselves as individuals, families, or societies, especially the historical ones, are rarely shared or passed down without some very selective editing. Be it conscious or subconscious, we interpret our pasts and make meaning from them in the light of our current lives and the backward gaze of knowing what occurred between those histories and ourselves. As a result, the complex figures of the past often become flattened into heroes or villains and lose the very universal messiness of humanity that would otherwise help us learn from them and connect with them. Welcome to Writing Westward. I'm your host, Brendan Rensing. This month, we talk with English professor Julie Carr about her recent book, Mud, Blood, and Ghosts: Populism, Eugenics, and Spiritualism in the American West. In relating the story of her great-grandfather, Carr demonstrates the power in thinking hard about the stories we've inherited and what we might learn if we dig into them with a more searching eye. Thanks for listening. For new listeners, allow me to take a moment to explain a bit about Writing Westward and myself. Each episode features a conversation with people writing about the North American West, historians, journalists, novelists, poets, scientists, sociologists, and others. By showcasing their work, I hope to spark your curiosity to think more deeply about the region, its lands and environments, and the histories and experiences of the peoples who call it home. If a writer or topic intrigues you, you can find links to their work in the show notes or at writingwestward.org. And if you have a moment, please do subscribe, share links with friends, leave us a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you're using to listen, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and send in some feedback. Writing Westward is supported by the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies at Brigham Young University, where I, Brendan Rensink, serve as Associate Director and an Associate Professor of History. For better or worse, this is a one-man operation, with me playing role of host, producer, sound engineer, publicist, and everything else, all tasks for which I have no training. But I am passionate about the North American West, so this difficult work is well worth the excuse to read more books and talk to interesting people. At the end of each episode, I'll include a little bit more information about me and my scholarship and about the Redd Center, our public programming and projects and funding opportunities that you could apply for. With that, let me introduce a little bit more about today's guest and why we're talking to them. Julie Carr is professor of English at the University of Colorado Boulder and chair of the Department of Women and Gender Studies. Her training and degrees from Barnard College, New York University, and the University of California, Berkeley are in creative writing, poetry, and English. She's the author of 16 books, most in the form of poetry and reflexive essays or prose, and many of which have won awards and honors. She has also published extensively in journals, poetry collections, and popular outlets like The New Republic, High Country News, The Nation, and others. She has traveled extensively to give readings, is involved in multimedia projects, and is co-host and co-creator of the brand new podcast, Return the Key, Jewish Questions for Everyone. In short, she is incredibly productive and varied in her literary and other works. This month we speak about her newest book, Mud, Blood, and Ghosts: Populism, Eugenics, and Spiritualism in the American West, published in 2023 by the University of Nebraska Press. The text is a family memoir of sorts, tracing the life of her great-grandfather, Omer Madison Kemp, who rose to national prominence as a three-term populist congressman representing Nebraska in the 1890s, after decades of failed farming and homesteading in Indiana and Nebraska. In subsequent years, he lived in southern Colorado and worked the land growing fruit and raising cattle, and by 1908 moved to Oregon where he owned a power company. Along the way, he became a dedicated spiritualist who communed with spirits, and a eugenicist concerned with issues of racial fitness in society. He's a complicated character, and by weaving her own observations of today's contemporary society, culture, and politics with Kemp's story, Carr shows how critical readings of our ancestral pasts can help us clarify where we came from and why our world today operates in the ways that it does. As these histories unfold across Western landscapes and are populated by uniquely Western events, themes, and concerns, Mud, Blood, and Ghosts can serve as an instructive template for all Westerners to take stock of the stories they've inherited of their family or community's pasts, ask questions of them, and more carefully understand them in their complexity before passing them on. It is surprising how much all of us can learn about how to examine our own pasts as we watch Julie Carr consider her populist, spiritualist, eugenicist forebearer. Professor Julie Carr, welcome to Riding Westward.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to talk.
Yeah, I'm very excited to work through this book with you a little bit and to recommend it to the listeners. It's a really wild ride and a really fascinating mix of history, family memoir, but you yourself are in there. There's contemporary politics in there. It's not kind of the traditional history as a lot of us are used to reading, I think.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm not a typical historian. In fact, I don't consider myself a historian at all. So that probably has a lot to do with that.
Well, you're faking it pretty well. You make it.
That's what I've heard.
Can you tell us a little bit about your personal relationship to the West and to the region? Did it factor into your family's identity as you were raised? Do you consider yourself a Westerner? How do you see yourself in the region?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So my dad's family, as the book is about, my dad's family are from the West, and he was born in Oregon and spent most of his life in, well, Oregon, Texas, Arizona, California. So he is definitely a Westerner. And my parents met in college at Stanford. So they met out there, but I was born in Boston and have lived most of my, you know, all my childhood, most of my young adult life in Boston and New York. So I actually consider myself an East Coast, Northeast person. But I went to grad school in California, moved here to Denver to teach at CU Boulder in 2006. So I've been here ever since. So that's actually quite a long time. Shockingly.
For a lifetime.
I guess. So, you know, I raised my kids here. But there's certain ways that I definitely don't identify as a Westerner, but I identify as somebody with Western roots, I guess you could say. But there are kind of more meaningful ways in which I feel connected to the place that do come out of partially come out of research and reading and the work of doing this book was part of that, was part of sort of my attempt to kind of understand my relationship to this place.
Now, as you're older, like looking back on your personal kind of, you know, family traditions, family lore, like looking back, can you now identify kind of Western inflections in that maybe you weren't aware of growing up as a Northeasterner?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think there is a kind of interest in land or in, and when I say land, I don't mean like property ownership, but I mean, you know, growing things on the land and sort of feeling oneself in relation to the land. And that, you know, might mean like I run a community garden is one thing I do. Of course, people do that all over the country. That's not a particularly Western thing. But there is this kind of, I think, curiosity. Maybe that's the best way to put it, is a curiosity about the land and the history of the land, which comes from, I think, in part, not this, you know, partly you could say, oh, it's this proximity to nature, blah, blah, blah. But for me, it has more to do with the proximity to a newer settler history. Like knowing that Colorado hasn't been a state, you know, all that much, you know, longer than 100 years in a sense, you know, and that there's this sense of Native history being very close or being still present in a way that I don't think we felt that it was. I mean, we were wrong in a way, but I feel like as white people, we didn't really feel that Native or Indigenous history in the Boston and New York area. It seemed like some ancient thing. And partly that's just being young and immature, but I think it is also a difference in terms of when settlement happened and how present that feels. So I'd say that that is something that became almost like palpable immediately upon moving here. And the other sense I think about the West is the sense of migration and movement, it's a different feeling than like the Northeast cities. Of course, you have this incredible sense of immigration. You know, people are, you know, there's new people all the time. And the feeling of the history of immigration is so rich, especially in New York. But here, it's more the sense of people are moving. Like there's a kind of feeling of, I think I describe it in the book as kind of this settler anxiety or this sort of sense of being unrooted. And, you know, I know that is not probably the case for everybody in the West and certainly not the case for indigenous people. But for people like me, sort of newly arriving, I think there's a sense of motion or of unsettledness that is that I might qualify as a kind of Western quality.
Yeah. I mean, none of this is like unique to the West, but these are themes and ideas that I think are quite prevalent in the West and that do kind of sometimes form core parts of Western identities or tropes or stereotypes.
Stereotypes a lot. Yeah. I mean, also that whole idea of space, right? You know, my father would, when we would take a trip to some Western state or other, my grandmother lived in California, so we'd go there a lot, but we also went to other states just for travel. And, you know, he would always remark on the sense of space and the, you know, the sky, the big sky, all of those kinds of things that felt like home to him and certainly are very much not present in the Northeast. That constriction of the Northeast is really real and is felt not just in the environment or in the urban environment, but also in the kind of personalities of the people. So I know these are cliches, but I also think that they have some truth. I mean, that sense of kind of motion and space is very real here. And I think I have gotten, if it's not part of my identity exactly, I'd say I've gotten used to it.
Yeah. I mean, all stereotypes are rooted in some core.
Yeah.
Like, so there's some kernel of truth in there.
Yeah.
So this book, it's a biography of sorts about your great-grandfather, Omer Madison Kemp. Uh-huh. He has a Wikipedia entry, which not everybody's great-grandfathers do. So that's something. But he really kind of exemplifies this sense of Western mobility from, you know, a failed farmer in Indiana in the 1870s, a kind of failed farmer in Nebraska in the 1880s. He then goes to Congress. That's quite unique. Maybe that's not typically Western. But then he does cattle and fruit in Colorado for about a decade and then moves to Oregon for the rest of his life. I mean, and this kind of mobility and diversity of careers, I think, is really common amongst a lot of Western figures. But then as you, in your research, peel back a couple layers, things get very messy very fast, which is also often the case with a lot of Western figures. But with your great-grandfather in some really unique ways that kind of turn your book into a rumination of grappling with what we've inherited from our ancestors, especially ancestors with some troubling stories. What did you know about Omer Kemp when you were growing up? What was the narrative that your family told about him?
Yeah, so there were a lot of sort of pioneer stories that, you know, I don't need to repeat. They're pretty standard. but there was also the story of Kemp as a populist. And so I grew up, you know, my parents were all anti-war, civil rights activists. My mother was especially very active in the anti-war and civil rights movements. So we had a, I guess, a progressive or liberal, you know, culture in which I was growing up. And that, and with that came a kind of admiration for this ancestor who had been, you know, in the sort of way that it was described, you know, kind of a fighting for the little man kind of, which is true, right? So, somewhat in some ways anti-capitalist, definitely outspoken, a speechifier, a fiery person who cared about justice, especially economic justice. And that seemed like a kind of heroic character to me and the way it was talked about. And the other thing I knew a little bit about, which we'll get into, was his relationship with this native healer, who was named Fleetwind. And this was talked about, I don't know if a lot, but it was definitely part of the family lore, was that he had this native healer friend. I don't know if it was told to me that the native healer was a spirit guide, in fact, you know, imaginary, but I didn't understand it if it was told to me. I just thought it was an actual friend. And why it was important, I wasn't totally sure, but it definitely seemed to be important. And the other thing I knew was that he was a spiritualist. And my grandmother, who I was close to, would tell me stories about, you know, she had stories about how she and one of her brothers would spy through the window on the grown-ups as they were holding their, you know, seances and things, and that they, you know, had contact with the dead. So that those were the things I pretty much knew. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you write about how you felt compelled to kind of break the silence on mm-hmm. some of the other things that you started yeah. to uncover. I mean, we'll work through these, mm-hmm. you know, as we go, but do you have like a bullet point list? Like, what are the things that, as you started researching, you were like, oh, whoa, this wasn't a part of the family story.
Well, okay. So, you know, when I started to research this, which meant reading the 11-volume autobiography that he had left behind, that he wrote in his life. He was a huge writer. And that autobiography is housed at Creighton University in Omaha. And I knew that it was there. Nobody had read it. We all sort of knew it was sort of like a joke in the family, like, oh, this library has our great-grandfather's stuff. That's weird. Maybe one day we'll go read it. But to us, you know, going to Nebraska was like going to the moon. You know, it's like, why would you ever go there?
That's what my wife said when we moved there for grad school.
Yeah.
Sight unseen. We'd never been. And she's like, really? Nebraska? We're doing this?
Yeah. What is that? Yeah. So, but, you know, obviously part of the story is that I moved out west, and then driving through Nebraska was kind of a normal thing that we did when we would drive across country. So eventually I went to go look at this archive, and with the idea of probably writing something. And the reason that I wanted to write about it was because I specifically wanted to better understand the settler history part. Like, what did it mean to be a homesteader in Nebraska in the 1880s? What was his relationship to or knowledge about native land or sovereignty or actual, you know, people that he might have known or known of if he didn't know anybody in particular? And this story of Fleetwind was kind of in the back of my mind. So I wanted to understand the settler's relationship to the land and to indigenous history and indigenous people. And I wanted to understand it partly because this was also the summer that I went to go to start to look was the summer of Standing Rock, which was really significant in the West and among people that I knew and was significant to me. So there was a kind of sense of wanting to uncover that. But what I didn't know at all was that he had become a eugenicist by the sort of early beginnings of the 20th century.
Could you define that word eugenics for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So eugenics is a belief in that through various technologies and practices, one can a society can breed more fit, which often means like smarter, stronger, more morally capable humans. Okay. So that breeding might happen through what's called positive eugenics, which is to encourage certain people to have more children because they are more considered to be more genetically pure or more genetically strong or more genetically intelligent. Or there might be negative eugenics, which is to discourage those negative traits from the gene pool. So that can happen through immigration restriction. It can happen through like literal isolation of people who are considered unfit to breed through institutionalization. or it can happen through forced sterilization of people who are considered unfit to breed. So essentially, it's like a what one might do with an animal population, you know, to breed for certain characteristics, but doing that to a human population through law.
So discovering this about him was something of a shock?
It was, yeah. There was no trace of that in the family lore. There was no discussion of his eugenics, and that might not be so strange, except for that we did know sort of almost everything else about him. And we also knew that he was an atheist and that he despised Christianity. You know, sort of all of his other belief systems were in the family lore, but this was absolutely not. And what makes
it seemed to be really prominent.
Yeah, exactly.
And prominent for decades.
Like for decades,
the entire kind of last 20, 30 years of his life, this was a big thing.
At least 30 years, yeah. No, it was a huge thing. In fact, it became really the dominant thing. I mean, as I started to read the letters, I mean, part of this autobiography is a record of letters. So as I started to read all of the letters that he was writing to family members and friends and politicians and newspapers and throughout the teens and 20s and 30s, there's almost no letter where he doesn't devote a few paragraphs to trying to convince the person of eugenics. He's passionate about it. He believes fully in it. And so he really shifts from looking to politics as a way of, or sort of ordinary politics, as a way of righting society's wrongs to looking at biopolitics or, the breeding of people as a way of righting wrongs or ills.
Well, maybe we can kind of move through this transformation then. I kind of identified three stages that are interesting to think about, and especially to think about like how these are either uniquely Western or they kind of provide us some unique insight into the West. Kem as a populist progressive politician, him as a spiritualist, and especially with this Fleet Wind character, and then as a eugenicist.
Yeah, sure.
So talk to us, what are some of the very Western, speaking of like Western stereotypes and tropes, this 1880s Nebraska homesteading context, socioeconomic world.
Right.
Describe to us kind of the very Western context of that that leads or pushes or leads him to be attracted to politics and specifically like populist politics.
Right. Yeah. So he arrives in Nebraska in 1881 on the Homestead Act and also the Timber Act, and almost immediately faces severe hardships. So, crops not coming in. His wife gets sick and dies. He's left having to mortgage half his land and sell the rest within the first couple of years. So he goes into pretty severe mortgage debt and has no money. You know, often, you know, the homesteaders would arrive, but they were very poor people and they had no money to buy things like equipment or animals or anything that you need to actually make it work as a farmer. But also they were misled about the climate. So thinking that they were coming
to the smack dab middle of Nebraska.
Custer County. Yeah.
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 Which is kind of past that aridity line, much drier than, say, you know, over in Omaha or...
Right. But. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's extremely dry. And, you know, the railroads, you know, had all kinds of propaganda, as we know, that lured people out there. And then he's coming, you know, with this idea of independence, that he's going to become an independent farmer. And this is, you know, this is the goal, but also it's an attempt to rectify the real severe poverty that he was facing in Indiana, which was actually to the level of starvation. I mean, you know, babies died of starvation.
And for listeners, that's where the mud comes from, because they were essentially trying to drain swamp lands and farm.
Exactly.
It.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we won't get into that probably. But yeah, the mud is the Indiana Mud pre-Swamp Land Act. Okay. So, so having arrived and finding that the farming that was this promised and the independence that was promised was nearly impossible, it was partially because of the climate. It was also because of the, you know, the unregulated railroad fees and rates It was also the unregulated mortgage industry, so they could charge whatever interest rates they wanted. They got the mortgage. I loved finding out about the mortgage companies in Nebraska in those years and how insanely rich these people got off of these mortgages. And then there were other issues, of course, around irrigation and the lack of public irrigation. So all of these things led the farmers to try to come together and help each other, essentially, through what were the farmers' alliances. And farmers' alliances were all over, really all over the Midwest and the West and also the South. So again, they weren't specific to the West, but they were extremely important to these farmers. And they were not just places to learn sort of techniques, you know, how do we farm this kind of land? They had come from very different climates. Now what do we do? You know, how do we pool our resources, that kind of stuff. But they were also places of education. And a lot of that education came through reading political tracts and books. So as a member of the farm, he became really a leader. I think he was just a natural sort of leader, kind of type of person, and became kind of a leader in the Farmers Alliance that he was part of, and then came to realize through the mid-80s that it wasn't enough to have this kind of mutual aid society. You know, it wasn't going to be enough to change things. Crop prices needed to be regulated. Railroad prices needed to be regulated. There was a feeling that of the demonetization of silver, which I don't really get into, but that was a big
all the
one
Wizard
for
of
the
Oz
populace.
Stuff.
Yeah, I don't really get that. But, you know, it's a big issue for the populace, you know, and so, and then also unfair, the lack of income taxation, and they felt that they weren't represented in politics, right? There was no representation for these farmers. So,
and early on, they tried like throwing their weight behind certain candidates, right?
Yeah.
They're like, okay, well, we're going to support so and so and so and so. But they get to this tipping point where they're like, that's not working. And so maybe we should just run our own.
Exactly. So they basically form a party. They call it the Independent Party at first, and then it's called the People's Party, and eventually gets, you know, dubbed the populists. And first it's state politics. And in, you know, many states, not many, but in the few states that the populists were really active, they won a lot of elections. And Nebraska is one of the places where they won almost all of the local elections so this would have been 1890 around then. And then they decide to go sort of next level and go to, federal representation. And so he runs as a populist for Congress and wins. So that, I think that answers the question, kind of how populism is rooted in that Western story. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he ends up running, he serves three terms. He's hitting like all of the populist high notes, right? Like railing against all these things that if farmers were promised independence, right? These myths of the West come out, self-made man, this almost free land, and then they find out all these things that are out of their control because of banks, railroads, these mortgage companies, like crop prices, and even the climate. Just so much is out of their control,
right?
And the crop lien system, debt, you write really interestingly about debt. At one point, I thought it was interesting, you talked about, where some of those other things might seem structural or structural problems.
Yeah.
When you get indebted, like in a crop lien system, that becomes deeply personal now.
Right.
And you might personally know the people that are getting rich off of your hard work.
Mm-hmm. And I think that debt, I mean, I read about debt in sort of borrowing from David Graeber's amazing book, Debt, the first 2000 years, we're thinking about debt in relationship to shame, that it's personal in the sense that you feel that it's your failing, it's your fault, that you owe someone something, right? So it becomes a dynamic between not just between sort of there's the banks, the anonymous banks doing bad stuff to the people. It's there's a debt between me and you, and you, I owe you. And there's a sort of imbalance that feels like it's your fault, right? And that there's that with that comes a kind of embarrassment or shame, especially, I think, when we're thinking about masculinity as well, and sort of myths of masculinity and independence. So
especially in the West, like the rugged individual, these rugged masculine men.
Right. And so, you know, to be indebted is sort of this exact opposite of to be independent. And we're all indebted all the time, of course, but this is this sort of stark exposure of that reality. And I think it rubs against that sense of selfhood that he and others are trying to establish. So, you know, one little anecdote that I thought was really fascinating was that when he went around to work his election, he was giving speeches off the backs of wagons or whatnot, and he would hold his mortgage, this piece of paper, as a kind of prop to the speech, right, and kind of wave it in the air as a sort of example, as a prop for what was wrong.
Yeah, and saying to his audience, like, you know, I'm one of you. You know, I'm,
yeah, exactly. They called him Brother Kim. That's they would cheer him as Brother Kim. Yeah.
Well, and all this is happening in this broader world of progressive reforms, and the West is often, you know, kind of been stereotyped as a place where. A region of opportunity, a place where people could experiment because cultural traditions and institutions aren't quite as established. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some have pointed to that being maybe one of the reasons that some of these progressive reform movements really get their earliest traction and successes out in the West, not just with populism and all these, you know, economic reforms, but prohibition, women's suffrage. I mean, just, you can go down the list, and the West is really at the forefront of most all of them. And the Westerners, I think we sometimes really like to celebrate that. Like you were even saying, like, in your family history, it was like, hey, you know, our family was at the forefront of pushing for, you know, really positive reforms.
Yeah.
My students, one of the funnest, you know, kind of moments if I'm teaching the U.S. surveys is laying that out, but then kind of taking the lid off and digging around in what are actually sometimes some very dark, very troubling motivations behind progressive reforms, and some unanticipated negative outcomes. You know, when you can start helping them to see that segregation and segregationists viewed themselves as progressive reformers often, right?
Uh-huh.
Are there other? So, my question of this is: are there other things, kind of in these early moments of Kim's political life, that you think reveal to us some of these darker unspoken things about the progressive era and progressive impulses?
Well, I mean, one of the things I read about is his relationship to native sovereignty or native land, right? So he arrives in Congress.
Even in his very first speech in Congress, right?
His very first speech in Congress, which is a speech about, it's in response to a debate that's going on around an Appropriations Act, where the question is, how much money should we appropriate for the building of Indian boarding schools, right? And so in that debate is a discussion of kind of where should the schools be? Should they be close or far from the reservation? And, you know, what works better in terms of assimilation, which is the goal? And he jumps on there and basically argues that there should be no Indian boarding schools, and that, you know, Native children should be educated on the reservations with their families. And in this, to me, I was incredibly proud, I guess you could say, reading
the speech.
Yeah,
the speech stops there.
Yeah, it does stop there, but the actions go on. Okay, so the speech is very surprising. He speaks about, you know, he blames white people for all of the wars with Indians. He blames white people for all of the aggression. He accuses white people of stealing Native land. And so all of this sounds, you know, sort of surprisingly progressive. But then during that very same session, he was legislating for the further further dispossession of Native people in Oklahoma. So Oklahoma had been pretty recently opened up for settlement, and there had been a huge land rush in 89. And he was basically putting forward the idea that instead of a land rush, we should have a lottery. And, you know, this is not, you know, maybe the worst thing you've ever heard in the world, but it is a way that he's just contributing to the legislation of further removal of Native people. Without any qualms about it. There's nothing in it where he says, you know, maybe we shouldn't be taking this land, but I guess since we are, you know, it's not even that. It's just kind of like, you know, white people should get that land in Oklahoma, but they should get it through a lottery instead of a rush. That's it. Contrast between words and deeds.
I also found interesting that you noted that in that speech, talking about boarding schools, he does pivot to taxes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it made me wonder if he was just using the, like, well, we shouldn't be building boarding schools, if he was because that's what the debate was about on the floor, if he used that as an entry point to simply get to the topic he actually wanted to address, which was taxation, and that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Like, if we tax the rich, we wouldn't even need to be having this conversation in the first place, because there'd be plenty of money to pay for everything. That's basically the argument. Yeah. So, yeah, he's beating his drum for sure. But a little bit later, he also legislates another attempts to legislate another law to remove Ute people from Southern Colorado, from a reservation in Southern Colorado, to remove them from that reservation to make that land available for the white people of Southern Colorado, where he then, just a few years later, goes to live. So, so this sort of contrast between, which I think is, it's a contrast between rhetoric and law. And that's something that you're going to see, like, all of the time, right, across U.S. history. It's not surprising, but it is important to pay attention to. So that was another, besides the eugenics. And I should say that, you know, as we get into talking about eugenics, that the justification for eugenics, or at least one of the justifications for eugenics, is specifically racial. So, you know, he's not just concerned about sort of the usual things that people might think about with eugenics, is that it's about ableism, which it is. You know, it's very much about sort of breeding out people with certain kinds of disabilities or with diseases or things that were considered to be genetic, such as even alcoholism. But in the U.S., as you know, eugenics is not specifically targeting racial groups as it does in Nazi Germany, but the sort of logic around segregation and the anxiety around blood mixing is exactly the same. I mean, it's the same rhetoric and it's the same logic when applied to sort of anxieties around Black people specifically, and when thinking about eugenics. And so I bring those two things into conversation because his anti-Black racism gets extreme in the same years that he is advocating for eugenics.
I mean, if you take some other steps back to you, when his daughter Iris was really interested in the kind of the birth control movement, like decriminalizing birth control, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, this is another topic where, like, well, that sounds very reasonable and progressive. But then you take a few steps back, and the rhetoric feeding into it is often about, like, well, the right people, it's not just about like women's health and women's sovereignty over their bodies. It's concerns about these new immigrants are having too many kids.
Yeah, exactly.
The Irish, and they're prone to alcoholism or whatever, mm-hmm. and they're having too much kids. And kind of the WASPs, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, their birth rates are going down.
Right.
Not to mention that out west, there's these concerns about Chinese and about people of indigenous or Hispanic, Mexican descent.
Yeah.
And
right,
there's always something behind the progressive movements that.
Yeah. Well, generally,
we don't give enough.
Yeah. When they're led by white people, generally that's the case.
Let's pivot to Colorado, because you brought up that he was advocating for the other additional removals of Utes from Southern Colorado, mm-hmm. and then he mm-hmm. soon thereafter ends up there in the area of Montrose.
Yeah.
to with some orchards and then later some cattle. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where the this Indian healer, Fleetwind. Right.
Fleetwind arrives. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's nothing uniquely Western, I don't think, about spiritualism per se. But as you're actually, I'm going to quote you. Sure. I always apologize when I quote people to themselves on the podcast.
No, I'm fine with it.
you write, he had admitted his settler guilt. We have taken possession of the land of the Indian. We have dispossessed him of his home. Rather than attempting to redress this injustice, to heal this wound, he imagined the spirit of an Indian healer, Fleetwind, entering and moving through his own body to heal him and his loved ones of whatever illnesses befell them. So, spiritualism may not be uniquely Western, but wow, this is incredibly Western. The settler anxiety and guilt over recent or ongoing dispossessions, and this way in which, in other ways, they, you know, they do it rhetorically, but kind of smoothing over this by indigenizing themselves in various ways, right? Playing Indian, honoring Indian traditions and so forth. Or in this case, him being healed by an Indian guide. This is doing a lot of work for settler conscience.
It is. Yeah. I was really baffled by it for quite a while. But, you know, the more I read and studied and the more I thought through it and kind of read his often, you know, the way that he would write about Fleetwind, the more I came to understand it in a particular way as, you know, kind of doing at least two things. I mean, one of them is that sense of sort of obviating the guilt. You know, he thinks of Fleetwind as a friend, right? As a really good and loyal friend, somebody who's accompanied him through many, many sort of trials and tribulations, who's always there for him when needed. He can call on Fleetwind. Anybody gets sick, let's say a kid has a fever, he can call on Fleetwind. Fleetwind, I should explain, Fleetwind comes through his body. Fleetwind's not like a ghost presence in the room. Fleetwind is a presence within his own body. So when he calls on Fleetwind, he feels Fleetwind in him. And then he does a kind of healing by placing his hands, Omer's hands, on whoever's sick, rubbing them, touching them. But the idea is that Fleetwind is doing that through him. So this is the idea of a spirit guide. He doesn't speak in Fleetwind's voice, but he heals through Fleetwind's presence. And he later, as he gets older, Fleetwind becomes more and more of a healer for him in particular. You know, as Omer gets, you know, chronic arthritis and other health problems, he would say be in physical pain and be lying in bed, and he would call on Fleetwind, and he would feel that Fleetwind had entered him and massaged his own body. And then he would relax and feel better. So part of this sense of this idea of, so I'll talk about the healing and the friendship, because I mean, of course they're one, but they're also different. So I think the friendship idea is that, you know, is a way, you know, I mean, you see this among, sorry to do the sort of call out of white people thing, but it is true. You see this among, you know, that idea of like, well, my best friend is black, you know, that sort of trope.
My great grandma was an Indian princess.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like I'm okay because I have this intimacy with this, you know, racialized other, that proves that I'm okay. I've been sort of, you know, blessed by that friendship. And I think this is really, really common in American society, and you see it in all kinds of ways. And so this is sort of part of that he, I think, knew very well what he was doing as a settler. He knew full well that the land was stolen. I mean, he said it many times. And he knew that it was wrong, and he said that many times. And yet he, of course, continued to profit off of that and to even legislate it. So there has to be something to address this problem. And in a way, this imaginary friend, you could say, addresses it through this imagined intimacy or this desire for intimacy. On the healing side, I think that, again, the sense that something, that there's something wrong and it needs to be addressed, But instead of, you know, as I write, like instead of him thinking, well, we did the wrong, so maybe we should address the problem, he you know, projects that action of healing onto the Indian himself, who then has to do the healing and heal specifically the white family. So those two dynamics. And then there's a third one, which I write about, which is that, you know, again, we were talking about this problem of settler, and especially sort of male settler identity, as being tied up in this idea of independence. And that idea of independence is tied to a relationship to the land, right? One has to be able to work the land, to control the land, to produce from the land, and to have, you know, that sense of ownership of the land in order to win the independence that one is supposed to have. And so that proves to be impossible for this particular generation for all the reasons we talked about. And so one way, it's how I came to think about it, is one way to get closer to that sort of authentic, legitimate American identity is to identify with the Indian, you know, and to become, basically to become one with the Indian, which is what he psychologically does.
Yeah, it's interesting. In his character, we see in Kem's character, these like repeated efforts to, I mean, heal maybe isn't, well, in this context is the right word, but you know, to rectify these problems, be it through like populist organizing, or when he moves to Colorado, there's not quite enough water in the valley. And so he proposes, and then eventually they succeed in building this. It's after he leaves, they build this tunnel, but to bring the Gunnison River water, like through miles of mountains.
Yes.
Again, right, to make this land right, or to make it so that they can survive and belong there.
Yeah.
Attempts to, you know, with all the racial stuff and eugenics, to make the population right, to fix it.
To fix
these are all like, these are all just like such real commonplace kind of progressive impulses that fueled like so much of that entire era.
Right. I mean, that's sense
I really see in him, like,
yeah.
In some ways, he's very unique and very strange. In other ways, he is just the prototypical man of his era.
Yeah. And so, you know, I was hoping in writing the book that, you know, because it is a little strange to write an biography of one's great grandfather. There's something about it that, you know, maybe kind of seems a little narcissistic or something. Like, look at my family, how interesting. But I was hoping that he, in all the ways that he is typical and also in the ways that he's strange, that he would provide a kind of window into some of these processes, structures, attitudes, et cetera, that, as you say, they're kind of, in some ways, they're kind of cliches, and yet they're real. I mean, he did have a sense that he was sort of uniquely positioned to transform the land, to engineer the land, to engineer the population, to address the problems and fix them. And I think that, you know, we carry that. That's not just a Western thing. It's an American thing too, right? And I think we definitely carry that impulse and that, whether it be sometimes misguided or sometimes hopeful, and sometimes positive, and sometimes you think it's positive, it turns out it isn't. But that kind of utopian vision, I think, is a big part of being a Westerner, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if more of us would really do like a real intensive dig into some of our ancestors, if we would find these very similar, not stories just like Kem's, but some of these same dynamics.
Yeah.
I think we would.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, it definitely was my hope that, I think we started by me saying I'm not really a historian. And I know I wasn't thinking that I was speaking to historians, though I have spoken to a lot of historians, but I didn't think of the book as sort of directed at historians. I mean, I think the historians of the West, you know, they know a lot of this history, you know, they may know certain parts of it more deeply and much more deeply than I do. But it was more a feeling of wanting to address just folks who might have some desire to understand their own ancestral history as a way of understanding U.S. Political and environmental and social dynamics better, you know.
Today.
So, yeah, today, yeah. Right.
I mean, you do this a lot explicitly throughout the book. You pivot between contemporary things and how you are reading contemporary events. Like you said, like the Dakota Access Pipeline, or, you know, various, you know, recent protest movements and other things, how you're reading them differently through the lens of this family history and the things that you're learning.
Yeah.
Do you feel that this project like profoundly changed how you view your contemporary life today?
I think the way that it probably changed me the most was in bringing a more skeptical eye on what we've just been talking about, sort of utopian imagining, or even progressive politics sometimes, you know, ways in which we tend to fall into believing that our vision for the world is right, is the only vision, and also a kind of like aggression, I think, often when we feel so righteous. You know, I think that's you know, kind of liberal righteousness is something that I what is like quite literally like in my blood, is something I was born into. And I think I have a little more skepticism about that now, and a willingness to kind of question some of the rhetoric, and even some of the ideas around transforming society. And it isn't that I'm, you know, kind of left, I'm less on the left or something like that. I'm not, but I'm still cautious, I think more cautious about, especially around kind of rhetoric. So that might be one of the things.
Well, you know? I mean, that's,
yeah,
that's powerful. I mean, that's what I think, what we're probably trying to ingrain in our students a lot of times as professors, not skepticism like in a cynical bad way, but like healthy skepticism, like, well, are you asking follow-up questions when, you know, a politician, whoever it is, kind of serves up for you on a plate this nice, neat package of here's the answer or here's the vision? We should always be asking lots of follow-up questions,
because
there's usually something more there.
And there's always more populations to consider too. I mean, I think that's one of the things, that another thing that this really left me with was, you know, for example, you know, when we talk about the irrigation, you know, and the Reclamation Act, and how massive Western irrigation transformed the entire region, and, you know, one cannot know about that without knowing the negative effects of the Reclamation Act on Native populations during the earliest part of the 20th century, which, you know, was huge, but also, of course, the terrible environmental result of all of this massive irrigation that's gone on and centrifugal pumping and all that on water in the West. At the same time, you can't sit around and go like, gosh, I wish the Reclamation Act never passed, because if it did, you wouldn't be here. If it hadn't passed, you wouldn't be here. Like, these cities would not be here. So it is this sort of complexity, I think, of looking at things that might have very positive intentions and unexpected consequences, maybe where not all populations were considered, and how do we move forward in ways that are visionary and are hopeful, but that also try to take more into consideration, you know, as we go.
Well, I think it's great work. And
thanks.
You may not consider yourself a historian, or that historians maybe isn't who you were talking to, but and I think everyone, there's a lot they could gain from this book, but I think historians too, there's lots of interesting things you do that historians don't traditionally do in kind of formal academic writing, but which have some unique power that I think maybe some of us historians should consider. Do you want to, we're about out of time, do you want to give us a little peek into what else it is you're working on, or what we might see from you next? Is there anything Western focused you're doing?
No, not really. So at the end of the book, I think about the fact that my mother was Jewish, and I was, you know, I was raised more or less Jewish, secular Jewish. And I think about the fact that eugenics, the U.S. eugenics, had a huge influence on the Nazi eugenics program, and on, and you know, U.S. policies had a huge influence on Nazism as a whole. And I think about the fact that some of my mother's ancestors, you know, were murdered by that sort of eugenic cause that we call Nazism, and while my great grandfather was promoting the same cause. And so this kind of dynamic, which is within my ancestry, yeah, I think is common, right? I think we all have these sort of competing strains often within our histories. But it has led me to do more research into that history, that side of the family, but also just kind of World War II history, and really interested in kind of the between the wars period, and thinking about World War I and how World War I was a real precursor for American fascism and American the KKK and a lot of other really nativist strains in American politics follow from World War I. And so that sort of dynamic, thinking about that sort of rise of fascism, has been something I've been studying and writing about and thinking about in different ways and different genres.
Well, playing historian clearly is a slippery slope, because even though you say you might, the outcome, whatever you produce, may come out in different ways, like you're I think you may be more of a historian than care to admit.
It's true. once you bite out of that apple, it's, you know, it's hard to put it down. So
I really appreciate you spending a little time with us. Congrats on the book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you asking me on the show.
All right.
Okay.
Take care, Julie.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you'll subscribe and listen every month. Please leave us a review on whatever app or platform you're listening through. Or follow us on Facebook at Writing Westward Podcast, or on Twitter at Writing West, where you can get updates and leave comments. Writing Westward is a production of the Charles Redd Center for Western Studies at Brigham Young University. We're an interdisciplinary research center that supports academic research and the promotion of public understandings about the North American West. We host regular public lectures, which we live stream, have an annual funding cycle with award, grant, and fellowship categories that nearly anyone researching or working on the region from any disciplinary approach or towards any final product can apply. Learn more at redcenter.byu.edu. That's R-E-D-D Center. Our theme music was provided by local Utah composer Micah Dahl Anderson. Find him at Micah, D-A-H-L, Dahl, Anderson, with an O, .com. I'll put a link in the episode description. My name is Brendan Rensink. I serve as the podcast host, producer, and just about everything else, so you can direct any praise or critique my way. I'm author and editor of a number of books on the West, borderlands, Native peoples, genocide studies, religion, and the environment. Recently, my book, Native but Foreign, Indigenous Immigrants and Refugees in the North American Borderlands, published by Texas A&M University Press in 2018, won the Best Historical Nonfiction Book Award from the Western Writers of America. In an anthology I co-edited with P. Jane Hafen, entitled Essays on American Indian and Mormon History, published by the University of Utah Press in 2019, won the Metcalf Best Anthology Book Prize from the John Whitmer Historical Association. Here at the Redd Center, I'm also general editor and project manager of a great digital history, public history project named Intermountain Histories. It's a free mobile app and website, intermountainhistories.org, that curates student-researched and written microhistories of the region, complete with archival photos, bibliographies, and more. To contact me about the podcast, my own research, or anything else, head to bwrensink, that's R-E-N-S-I-N-K.org, or follow me on Twitter at Brendan W. Rensink. Until next month, be well, be curious, and be kind. Cheers.